Traveling home for the holidays? Well, with the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles on any purchase you make today and every day. And those miles add up to get you closer to that trip home. Every time you pump gas, double miles. Every time you get your nails done, double miles. Or if you're in charge of buying the turkey, yep, double miles. You earn unlimited double miles on every purchase, and then you go. The Capital One Venture Card, the card that takes you there. What's in your wallet?
Capital One Bank USA N.A.
The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Dave.
You got it.
Hey, how you doing? This is Gene calling from Third Eye Cinema.
Good, man. How are you?
Good. So can you hear me okay?
All right. Yeah, I'm driving right now, so if I lose you or something, just call you right back or you call me back.
So,
that's cool.
Yeah, that's fine by me.
Yeah, I'm kind of driving out in the weeds, so I don't know how the signal is going to hold up around some of these turns, you know?
Right.
Kind of crazy.
All right. How's the weather out there in
Cleveland? It's like 85.
Wow.
It's hot.
Yeah, we got the same thing going on here today. It's crazy. You know, we had like two weeks where it was icy cold, and now it's back to being summer again.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of the same thing. It's nonsense.
So if you think you're ready, I can get started.
Oh, yeah. Go right ahead.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema and music. Tonight, Dave Gravy-Felton of Criad Diaz and Sandy Sledge of War Bride, Malibu Barbie, and Sledge Leather on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film and music that matters. Cult, grindhouse, driving, independent, and underground film, music from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, we've got an interesting double bill for you. First, touching on a metal genre we usually don't tap into, and then discussing war stories with a woman who's been there from the beginning, part and parcel of no less than four all-female metal acts throughout the 80s and beyond, fighting cultural resistance and breaking boundaries in the days long before the whole alternative thing and the Riot Girls came along. But first up, we're stretching the boundaries a bit and talking something a bit outside our usual focus musically. We'll be talking with a man whose former act was a fairly major concern in mainstream terms, with tracks appearing on the soundtracks to two major studio horror films and providing the theme for a major professional wrestling event. Mushroomhead made the charts and carried with them a considerable fan base. Now leading the charge with his own project, which taps into a very 90s metal aggro meets southern groove vibe while pulling in some unusual for the style musicianship skills. Please join us as we talk the road from Mushroomhead to his own band, Criad Diaz, with the guitarist Dave Gravy Felton. But first, just to give you an idea what we're talking about, here's Criad Diaz with Bloodline.
Don't miss your bed. I am one man.
Tonight, we're going a bit outside our comfort zone. We have with us a band led by a man who was part of a fairly major concern in mainstream terms, with tracks appearing on the soundtracks to at least two major horror pictures and providing the theme for a major professional wrestling event. His former band made the charts and carried with it a considerable fan base. Now leading the charge with his own project, which taps into a very 90s metal aggro meets southern groove vibe. Please join me in welcoming guitarist Dave Gravy Felton, formerly of the band Mushroomhead, and now with his own band, Creadiaz. I'm assuming I said that right.
No, that's right, man. You got it.
Dave, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
All right, man. Glad to be here.
So what is with the nickname Gravy anyway?
No, it's just my first name's Dave, so Davey Gravy is one of those type of things.
I figured they brought out the chicken and biscuits, and that's it. You're digging in. And
well, that happens too, but that's not where the name came from. It fits, though.
Now, just to get this out of the way before we get started, now, I have to be honest with you, the sort of music you were working with Mushroomhead, and to a lesser extent here with Creadiaz, is way outside my ballpark. You know, I'm a diehard 80s guy with 70s influences.
Uh-huh.
I'm working more of this 90s, new metal, aggro, southern rock hybrid that picks up on that Pantera vibe. And your last mention, more by the way, of like a Slipknot, Faith No More, Marilyn Manson kind of vibe. So just realize that my take is coming into this from somewhere outside the usual fan base. But let me say two things right off the bat. First of all, in terms of Mushroomhead, I have to admit, I find Jason J-Man Popson to be a pretty decent singer. While there's still a lot of that kind of grunting and the corn meets Phil Anselmo about way of New York hardcore style screaming, his clean vocals were clean and a lot smoother with some tonality to them. But something like 13 and tracks like Sun Doesn't Rise or the Seal cover Crazy.
That wasn't him. That was Jeff. Yeah, Jeffrey Nothing was the clean singer, and J-Man was he did the rhythmic stuff, the rapping, and like the hardcore vocals.
Okay, because that's what I was catching. I was like, wow, this really sounds a lot different than where they were going later. So okay. Secondly, for the general sound you're going for now with Creadiaz, which seems to be a lot more indebted to the southern rock, Zakk Wylde by way of Exhort or Pantera into the equation, some of the musicianship on display is more notable than what I'm usually hearing from bands in that style. So on that point, it's pretty clear that you're a proper musician with some decent solos and bluesy acoustic fingerstyle dobro playing. Within this general style, Creadiaz really does stand out for touches like that. So what attracted you to the more simplistic, stripped-down sound that Mushroomhead seemed to be reaching for?
It wasn't something that I was going for on purpose. That band was, you know, I wasn't an original member.
Right.
So I got in it right before they got the major deal and all that kind of stuff. So I was just writing to fit that band. I wasn't really doing much for myself. Although, I mean, if you listen to it, you can kind of hear certain riffs and certain things kind of being shoehorned in. But I kind of wasn't really allowed to be myself in that band.
Right.
So the Creadiaz thing is more like pretty close to me just doing my thing, you know?
Speaking of this, let's backtrack a bit. You know, first of all, both bands hail from Cleveland, Ohio, which is also the home of my favorite still active punk band, the Vladimirs, and the great U.S. black metal
right.
Hell's Headbangers. But given the sound and approach of Mushroomhead, which came complete with masks, costumes, and pseudonyms, with at the very least Slipknot, Insane Clown Posse, and Twisted hailing from the relatively nearby home bases of Iowa and Michigan, what is it about the Midwest in particular that makes it a hotbed for this sort of industrialized aggro new metal thing?
I don't know if it's the area or not, because there's a ton of stuff here that nobody ever hears about that doesn't sound anything like any of that stuff. There's a lot of underground hardcore bands, a lot of new type thrash metal bands, and all kinds of stuff like that. I mean, it's a big mix of everything around here.
Right.
So that's, I think, just what seems to be coming out as far as getting across to people more. But there's a ton of the same stuff everywhere. I don't know if it's really, if you can nail it down to an actual location, you know.
But seriously, the masks and costumes, the stage performers and dancers, it reminds me of stuff like Mr. Bungle, Slipknot, and Psychotic Symphony, who are pretty much unforgettable in the movie Bad Channels. So where did all that come from?
Well, those guys, before any of this, I was in a band with Jeffrey and my brother Skinny. We were in a band called Hatrix before Mushroomhead even was a thought. And that was, we were all real young, and I was studying music a lot, so I was like throwing in lots of shreddy guitar harmonies, and I kind of like how a lot of the modern prog metal bands are today. I was doing in the late 80s and early 90s with those guys, and you know, I'm like a hard rock metal guy. I like a lot of stuff from the 70s and 80s and stuff like that, but those guys, just right before the grunge thing kind of hit, there was like this weird underground thing with like Jane's Addiction and the Chili Peppers and
Faith
No More and Mr. Bungle like that, and those guys kind of gravitated more to that and kind of steered themselves away from the metal thing that brought them up to begin with. And that's kind of where the Mushroom Head thing formed from that. I could have joined it from the beginning, but I was, you know, I was working full-time, playing in a cover band, and we were doing that band Hatred, like our kind of prog metal band for the time.
Right.
So I didn't want to, like, add another band to it, you know what I mean? It was just... it was too much.
Exactly.
So, you know, they went on to do that, and they got a little more successful, even though Hatrix had a deal back then, too, in the early 90s. The Mushroom Head thing just kind of took off around Cleveland, became kind of like a Cleveland staple.
So you were with Mushroom Head for the better part of the band's career, from their third album, M3, right through to last year with Beautiful Stories for Ugly Children being, I think, your last album with the band. Now, given just how many people appear to have cycled through the band over the years, that's saying something right there. I think there's something in the range of 20 members passing through the roster.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that many. I mean, there's probably 6 or 7 people off the top of my head I can think of that have been in and out of it since the beginning.
Do you think it's also saying something that when you joined the band, it's pretty much signaled the move from self-release to actual label signings? Because it wasn't too long after that Mushroom Head was getting major exposure on Universal and then Megaforce.
Well, what happened was it was doing so well just playing local and regionally that the major labels got interested in it. And that was before I was even in it or anything. But, you know, I was close to those guys, so I kind of knew what was going on. But, you know, just from the sales in town, the label started getting interested. And then there was an independent label called Eclipse. They signed with them and sold a substantial amount of records, and that's when Universal got interested in it. Right between the Eclipse thing and the Universal thing is right when I got on. When I first got in, I was just a hired guy, because they had got rid of the one guitar player for, you know, personal business reasons. So I replaced him just as a hired guy. And then when we got the first tour opening for Wasp, which was pretty interesting, I was kind of like, you know, hey, we can't afford to pay you as a hired guy. So if you want to just join the band, I was like, sure. So that's kind of how that all got started. And that first national release, the Double X album, that first was on Eclipse, then was on Universal, that was basically a best of. It was all the independent releases, all the best songs of the independent releases put on one release for the major label thing.
And you actually got some serious exposure during your tenure playing Ozfest, getting tracks on horror film soundtracks like Freddy vs. Jason and Saw 6, even getting used as the theme for a TNA wrestling pay-per-view. Yeah, you guys were even on the Billboard charts. That's nothing to sneeze at.
We did some stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was that like for you? I mean, I guess I hate to say coming out of obscurity, but, you know, playing local bands and all of a sudden there you are with that kind of exposure.
It was definitely cool. I mean, one of the coolest things was, you know, getting on the big festivals and then all of a sudden you're playing the same day Slayer's playing or
right.
somebody big like that, and it's, you know, then you go to catering tent and there's you look over and there's like Zach Wilde or somebody like that. It's kind of cool that, you know, you grow up talking about these bands and listening to these guys, and then all of a sudden you're kind of right there rubbing elbows with them. So
right.
It's kind of surreal, but really cool at the same time. You know,
there were a few interesting tidbits along the way, too, like the fact that you played New Orleans about a week before Katrina. You know, did you guys bring the Wrath of God down in the Big Easy or something?
I don't think we had anything to do with it, but it's kind of, you can kind of look at it that way. Yeah, we've dodged a few bullets like that on the road, actually. There was some other play, I can't remember, man. There was like something else where a tornado whipped through or something. I don't know. Oh, you know what? I know what it was. We were in New York City like 2 days before 9/11.
Oof. Wow.
Like literally. We played a club in New Jersey, took a train from New Jersey just to go, you know, walk around downtown New York. And I remember coming out, the train came out of the one tower.
Oof.
And it was just interesting to be watching the news a couple days later. It's like, man, we were just there and this is what's going on down there. That was pretty heavy.
That's it. You either bring it with you or you're dodging bullets. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts.
Now, there were a few more bum notes towards the end. First, I should mention that you guys had a longstanding and very public rivalry going with Slipknot, which was just kind of strange. What was that all about?
I'm not really sure, because a lot of that stuff happened before I got in the band. But I kind of remember Roadrunner Records being interested in the Mushroom Head thing and all of our side projects, and them getting a package of all of our stuff. And like I said, all this, this isn't like 100% factual. So if I'm wrong, don't anybody come down on me about it. But I think Roadrunner was interested. They got all of our stuff and Mushroom Head didn't take the deal with them. So I think they kind of made Slipknot out of what they had, because I noticed certain like logo things on certain shirts and stuff. It's like, wait a second, that's from one of our other side projects.
I gotcha.
And that's, what is that doing there? That's been on a Mushroom Head t-shirt for years, like locally. So it was just, I mean, it could be coincidence. I don't really care one way or the other.
Right.
And like I said, I might not even be 100% right. My take on it is that Mushroom Head didn't take the deal because it wasn't very good, so they made Slipknot because I think they felt that they could exploit that, you know?
Right. So this is all speculation, folks. So
yeah.
You also lost John J.J. Rice's Secular a few years back at a relatively young age. Of course, he was booted from the band way back in 2001, but still. And finally, you parted ways with the band, I gather involuntarily, last year. And apparently this wasn't the first time they wanted you out of the band. So what was going on?
It's just, you know, it's the same thing that happens with every band. You know, there's egos and there's corruption and a certain amount of partying that goes on and stuff like that. And, you know, I don't have a problem with any of that stuff. I'm not like a big partier. I don't have a problem with my abilities or anything like that. I think maybe I cared more and I started questioning things and maybe, you know, threw up some red flags with some people, ruffled some feathers, and I think it was just easier for me to be let go than it was to fix certain problems.
I hear you. So yeah. We'll move on from that one.
So yeah. I mean, dude, if I got into details with you, your head would spin.
Well, I'd love to, but you know, we can keep that off air.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Pink Floyd thing, but completely the opposite. If you know what happened with Roger Waters and Pink Floyd, it's kind of exactly the same thing, but totally flip-flop.
Tell us about Creatias and how you got the new gig started.
Well, actually, one of the Mushroomhead side projects was called 216, and that was a straightforward metal thing, kind of Fear Factory-ish, you know, kind of Pantera-ish, kind of like Creatias, but just not as much musicianship. Like, those guys always kind of, I don't want to say they held me back, but it always seemed like they, whenever I wanted to do a lot of shredding or do anything more interesting, it was kind of frowned upon. And I didn't mind, whatever, you know, in the 90s, nobody was really ripping it up playing solos anyway. So,
yeah, exactly.
But anyway, that band was doing extremely well. I mean, we were drawing between 500 and 800 people a show in Cleveland, and,
wow,
you know, we were starting to go to some other place, stuff like that, but it kept getting put on the back burner over and over and over again, years and years and years. I mean, the first 216 record came out in 98, and instead of nurturing that, other side projects were created, and a lot more was going into that. And after like 10 years of listening to the fans complain about it and myself complain about it, you know, I got tired of waiting around. And I said, screw this, man. I'm going to start another band, you know, because this is more like what I do.
Right.
It's like everyone needs an outlet, you know, and not that playing and writing those Mushroom Head songs wasn't an outlet, but I wasn't doing exactly, I wasn't just being true to myself.
Exactly, right. You're working with other people and you're going towards whatever direction the group goes as opposed to going in your direction.
Right.
I hear that.
So yeah, I started that with some old friends of mine. The drummer has been in my, you know, we've been jamming together in a cover band for like 17 years. So, you know, we just do it. It's like second nature to jam with that guy. He's a genius. You know, I found a young guy that has a home studio and he's really into doing things a certain way. I kind of agree with the way he likes to record and stuff. So we had a discussion about recording the records. I just planned on putting it out for a local thing. We pulled out as many favors and stops as we could to get stuff done as cheap and as quality as we could, doing it ourselves. Like a year later, here we are with a label release. Yeah, it's cool.
It looks like vocalist Mike Ruzz is a newcomer. I don't see any prior band credits for him. So did he just come audition, or did you meet up through mutual friends?
No. We've all known him for years. Actually, it's a strange family tree of people. Mike was the rhythm guitar player in a band called Ritual, which featured our drummer, Emery Seo, and Pig Venus from Mushroomhead was in that band with those guys before he was in Mushroomhead. So that's what I mean. There's like a weird family tree of people that goes around all this stuff. So yeah, Mike has always been a rhythm guitar player. And he actually, a few years ago, 10, 12 years ago, he started a cover band with some guys as vocalists. And, you know, I remember going to see him one night. And, you know, they're doing Chili Peppers and 311, you know, just radio stuff, common stuff. Well, they did that Drowning Pool tune, Bodies Hit the Floor, and he, like, totally tore it up with, like, a metal voice. He was throwing in these real low death metal vocals and, like, those big screams and all that stuff. And I was like, holy crap, man, I didn't know this guy could do any of that stuff. So So, you know, when I started thinking about doing something new, he was like the first guy I had in mind for vocals.
Now, when I first dropped the needle on the album, I thought I was listening to Ry Cooder, maybe Jakey Lee's Badlands. Nice dobro work there. But then it kicks right into this whole Phil Anselmo territory. So where did you decide on this mix? Was it what you were coming out with Mushroomhead, or was this more of, you know, just putting all your influences on the line? Or
the style of the band? Like just
the fact that you throw in so much of this like dobro work and acoustic stuff, and it's all kind of bluesy and folky, and all of a sudden it comes in and bam, you got the whole Pantera Exhorter kind of thing going on.
That, like I said, that's just me doing my thing, man. I like it to be sonically devastating like that. Influence comes from Crowbar. It goes back to the roots. You know, I dig old Van Halen. I like Ozzy with Randy Rhoads. Old Metallica, Sabbath, you know, Queen, and all that kind of stuff. So I'm like a riff rock kind of guy, but I like the devastating,
bit overpowering kind of thing.
Heavy, the metal sound. Yeah, like, I mean, it's definitely a metal album, but there's a lot of rock elements to it and stuff. And that's just me doing my thing. I don't really even think about it. I just write the riffs. And if a blues sounding thing sounds good here, I use it. If a classical thing kind of sounds good here, I use it. And, you know, those acoustic things, like the, you know, the country picking things, I just threw in as kind of like a tribute to old Van Halen and Zakk Wylde.
And, you know, on the same lines, you're going on the same point. You know, there's some nice leads on the album, because in the middle of all this, you know, basically like Pantera by way of Black Label Society and Larry D. Metallica kind of riffing and screaming and whatever, then we get this, like, it's reminiscent of like Zakk or Jake, that sort of loose but accomplished feel on the guitars. And you have to admit, you know, hearing slide guitar tossed in the middle of all this machine gun groove metal riffing is pretty jarring. You know, it made my eyes widen more than once or twice,
right.
like in 10 Lies.
A lot of people, when the first time I played that for some people, they were like, where the heck did that come from? That's really cool.
Exactly.
And I actually don't use a slide. I bake it with a whammy bar. Yeah, so that's even puts a little bit more of a, puts a whole new paint job on things.
And that's what I was getting at here. I think that the catchiest track on here is probably Feed the Rats. You know, I can definitely see an audience full of heads bobbing and bodies pogoing to this. But I'm still taken with Bloodline. You know, it's such a jarring mix of styles and probably the most consistently up-tempo riff on the album. You know, at the very least, it's very Cowboys from Hell in approach.
A little bit, yeah. It's kind of like bordering on hardcore and thrash metal, which is kind of where Pantera came from and Metallica, some old Metallica and stuff like that. So that's just kind of how that came about, you know. And I always, like I said, it's just my style. I try to put in some kind of riff instead of just a bunch of chopped metal all the time.
Right.
You know? Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's like I said, I'm just doing my thing, man. I want the tunes to be fun and not like, I mean, I could write crazy progressive stuff all day long, but I don't get to pick up my instrument as much as I like to. So, you know, I try to write stuff that's in that comfort zone. So I don't really have a, you know, if it's a throw and go type show situation, I don't have to worry too much about warming up.
Trust me, I know.
I can still pull the stuff off, you know.
Trust me, I know I'm a guitarist myself, even though I haven't been playing out for years. And I just did the same thing. It's kind of like, I hate to say I got lazy, but it's like, well, I got a comfort zone. I know I'm good in it. I know everything I do is safe. Just I don't have to warm up. I don't have to think about it. So that's where I'm at.
Right. But there's still, like, you know, it's not that the stuff is super simple to play. Some of it is, but, you know, whatever. Like I said, I just want to have fun. I want to have a good time playing.
Exactly.
You know, I'm not trying to, I don't need to, like, prove my musical manhood all the time.
Exactly. You get over that stuff when you're like 18, so.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, you've gone the self-release route here with Pavement Productions, but you've nonetheless managed to put out a video for The Rebuilding, and it looks like it's at least a three-camera setup with tracking, so I can't imagine that came too cheap.
Well, actually, I got a buddy of mine that, you know, he's got like a crew of a couple guys on his crew, and we just put all our heads together and our resources, and we did it fairly, I don't want to say like cheap just sounds exactly like that. It was a shoestring budget, and we pulled it off pretty well.
Yeah, because it looks good, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we're all pretty, like, blown away how it came out.
So all you folks out there who are into the whole groove metal, aggro vibe, all you Pantera fans, definitely check out Creati Ads when they come to your area, because the album should be out by the time this airs. And on that note, what are your upcoming tour plans?
Right now, we don't have any.
Really?
We've been doing a lot of stuff just locally and regionally and stuff, and we're kind of just waiting to see how this thing does. But I'm sure will be out there eventually.
Do you have anything you want to plug, or do you want to point listeners to your website or your Facebook page?
If you want to like talk to anybody in the band personally, we all have like personal sites. You can just go to Dave Felton at Facebook and go to Mike Ruzz at Facebook, Brian Trembley, the bass player. There's a Creedia's Facebook page. We got like tons of cool merch and stuff like that. So if anybody wants a shirt or a hoodie or something like that, you can check that out. I actually, with the release of the new record, there's a whole different album cover and everything like that. So there's like new merch in the works right now. So just a lot of cool stuff with the band coming up.
Well, with that, Dave, I'd like to thank you again for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and all the best with the new album.
Right on. Thank you. Appreciate all the questions and your time, man. It was great.
So appreciate your time.
Cool, man. Oh, you got it, dude. I appreciate your time, man. Thanks, man. You have a great one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And to close out our interview with Dave, here's another pair off the self-title. First off, a little more of that Dober work with St. Louis Combo, leading into a track called Never Down.
All right.
Wow.
folks, this is IQ Priest from Dark Age, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. We are really happy to be on the show, so check out our stuff. See you soon.
Hey, I'm Marcus Thomas. I'm the guitar player and vocalist for the Vladimirs and Sono Morte, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
This is Brian Day of the Vladimirs, Sono Morte, and any other metal band that you know that I have been a part of, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema, and you should continue to listen to this until your ears bleed.
Me too? Oh, okay. All right. I'm horrible at these things. Hey, I'm... Yeah, this ain't gonna work. Hey, guys. I'll try it serious this time. All right. Hi, I'm crying. No, I'm sorry. I can't do it.
Hi, this is Udo Dobson, the singer of UDO, and you're listening to the show Third Eye Cinema.
Greetings, pathetic mortal scum. This is Chris from Gloriana, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
That's my evil wizard.
Wow, that was great. Can you do one in the pirate voice?
Sure, I could be Captain Chris from Aelstorm if...
Go on that. Sure.
God, that's all I do is put on fucking accents all day long. All right. Ahoy there, shipmates. This is Chris from Aelstorm, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Yar.
Well,
I hate myself.
No, that was great. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. Sandy.
Hi, Gene.
Yes, it is. How you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Good. How's weather out there in L.A.?
Sucks.
Well, that's succinct.
Sucks. It used to be good, and then it turned to be the summer of hell for us. Yeah, that's not happy. That's not what I signed up for. But thanks for asking. Supermassively hot. Yesterday, it was cloudy, so it was nice. It's just been supermassively hot in the 90s for like a month.
Glad I'm not out there right now.
Oh, no, yeah, for sure. And where are you?
In New York City.
Oh, nice.
All right, so if you're ready, we'll get started.
Sure.
Next up, we speak with legendary metal drummer Sandy Sledge. As the driving force behind a number of all-female bands throughout the 80s and early 90s, including Rude Girl, Malibu Barbie, and War Bride with the amazing Yngwie-styled guitarist Laurie Lindstedt, MI Pitt graduate Sandy has worked numerous times with the great Levi Leone of Chastain fame before taking a right turn to the world of musicals. Now, after 20 years apart, Sandy and Leather have reunited to deliver a haunting yet hard-hitting slab of traditional-style metal, filtered through a postmodern crunch. Join us for an entertaining and informative discussion with Sandy Sledge, only here on Third Eye Cinema. But first, just to give you an idea what we're talking about, here's Sandy and Leather back in the 80s with Malibu Barbie. This is Lords of the Night. Tonight we have with us a woman who's been a driving force behind a number of exclusively all-female metal bands, backing up the legendary Leather Leone in no less than two separate bands during the heyday of the genre in the U.S. during the 80s. She and Leather have been recently reunited to give us a classic slab of hard-hitting traditional metal. Allow me to introduce Miss Sandy Sledge. Sandy, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Oh, what's up? Hey, thanks for having me.
You originally worked with Leather and Rude Girl, with Bose LaRue on guitar and Delphine Knight on bass. I don't believe you put out any demos or albums during that time, but it was an all-girl band, which is something you've done pretty much throughout your career. So speaking in general terms, how did you manage to pull that off no less than three times during the 80s?
Wow. How did you manage to pull that off? Okay, first let me address, okay, so it's Delphine Need, actually, but she's passed away, so I guess she's not going to call in and say, hey. Am I allowed to swear, by the way?
Go right ahead.
Okay, so she's not going to call and say, hey, motherfucker, you got my name wrong. But we love her. And she was amazing. And we have a song on the new CD coming up called Scared of Heights that's going to be the epic, and it's her eulogy. Oh. She was a big part of what happened with Rude Girl, because we sort of had classic metal, Sabbath influences, and then she brought in new metal, new wave of British heavy metal influence, and really helped shape what was become sort of our destiny, mine and Leather's, from then on. We did release demos, but they got swallowed up so quickly by label interest that we didn't have to spread them around that much. I don't know if that sounds egotistical. I don't mean to be. But they were out there, and we got picked up so fast that it just was a different kind of a thing. The all-girl thing, I want to say the all-girl thing worked, and that's why I kept repeating the pattern. But, how does it work? It works in the fact that it's a novelty and it's easier to get booked, honestly. And it works in the way that it's us against the world because, that's kind of what metal is, right? It's kind of for the underdog. It's kind of for the, hey, we're going to speak out our truth no matter what you motherfuckers say.
Right.
And, man, there's no more underdog thing than being, an all-girl metal band. It's hard. It's really hard. You can be an all-girl Philly pop band and wear skirts and stuff, and you're totally accepted and loved. But the minute you go on stage with ripped shirts and black leather and chains, you're dykes, you're horrible, you're man-haters, and we were nothing of the sort. None of the bands were nothing of the sort. And even if we were, who cares? It's about the music, right?
Exactly.
But it makes it really difficult. And I know it made it difficult for the girls after us in that Riot Girl. I've read some stuff where, some of those bands actually got threatened by guys who were just overwhelmed with fear or something. I don't know.
Seriously? Wow.
Yeah. But I kept doing it because of those reasons. I like the challenge, and I like that sort of grit and intensity that comes with being the underdog and being able to play metal. It gave it an extra fuel, an extra fury.
Yeah, because I was going to say, if that's true, that says a lot more about the guys involved than you guys. So that's pretty sad.
it's so hard that, not a lot of them do it.
I was going to say, because, all female bands are kind of rare right up to this day, but especially back in the 80s, and especially in metal, because you had the Runaways, but they were more of like a rock glam thing. You had Girl School in the UK, but there wasn't that much. I mean, and you had at least three bands that were just all-girl bands. I was like, wow, how the hell did you pull that one off? You really had to have some, I don't know what, stick-to-itiveness to take all the shit that you had to take and, get your name out there.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of shit to take. I want to be egotistical, but I don't know how many girls played drums like I did. And I think that had something to do with why a lot of them didn't make it. I think finding a girl drummer who could really play, especially during then, was super, super hard.
Yeah, I mean, I got a lot of respect for Sandy West, but, most people don't even notice that. They just think it's a novelty, like, okay, yeah, it's part of a girl band. They don't appreciate how good she really was.
She really was.
Later down the road, we got other bands. Phantom Blue came out, Vixen, Mean Streak, and then, of course, your next two bands, Malibu Barbie and Warbride, which we'll get to in a bit. But, like I was saying, this staff involvement in hard rock and metal, it was kind of few and far between, especially when you go past bands where you got a female singer, but the rest of the band's all guys. So who were your inspirations? What led you to get up there on stage and kick ass at a time when most females were more likely to be influenced by, like, Madonna or a new wave act than something as hard as you guys were putting out there?
Right. Well, for me, you know, my best friend growing up, Mike Goldzweig, was a drummer. We were best friends from like seventh grade on. He never blinked an eye. I mean, we washed and waxed cars. We did wax on, wax off before we knew what we were doing, that we were strengthening our arms. We were just making money. And we did that stuff, and we played sports, and we played drums, and we partied, and we went skiing. And you know, it was like sort of a brother. I had other brothers, but this guy did a lot of that stuff with me. And so I would say that, you know, he was a big inspiration, because we'd go to the basement, and he had a big drum kit, and we would take turns playing to, you know, like Rush, really, like Neil Peart.
Right.
So right off the bat, you know, we were playing hard stuff. So I would say I was influenced musically by people like Neil Peart and Carl Palmer from Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and the drummer from Jethro Tull, because my sisters were 9 and 10 years older than me. They gave me all these records that I never would have been exposed to. Keith Moon wasn't my era, but this stuff was coming my way.
So you really
were
shooting right for the top there, because, I mean, those are some
of
the best drummers ever.
And I could, and that was the thing. It was just all natural. I just sat down and could play, like, right away. So what I heard, I could play, and I did. And so the combination of those two things. And then I remember the first time that I saw the Runaways album, and I was definitely influenced. I mean, majorly, it was the, oh, I can do this moment. I saw her, and then we had the same name, and I was like, oh, it was over. I was like, oh, I can do this. Let's do it. So I started to try to get into a band right away, and that was before I could drive. And the first people that called me were all girls. So it was a terrible band. We played Lola by the Kinks for 45 minutes.
Like
horrible.
The Blues Brothers.
right. But after that, I got my license, and so I could go out and audition. And I joined a band in downtown Chicago. I mean, I went for the audition with my best friend Andy at the time, and she's like, yeah, let's go for it. We went down there, and it was all guys, and they're looking at me like, can you really play? And their other drummer's kit was there, and it was huge. And I was like, oh, I can play.
Right.
And we played like UFO and Scorpions. I mean, all this like stuff that I had never really been exposed to.
Right.
And I just played the hell out of it. And they were like, yeah. And so that was me starting to play with all guys. And I did that all the way up through the end of college until I got to San Francisco. And then that's really where the all-girl thing really kicked in, because obviously the girls there were a little bit more adventurous,
right?
You know, and gutsy and ballsy. So,
right.
You know, they accepted me, and they were like, no, not they accepted me. Anyone accepted me. They were better players than I had experienced in other towns.
So how did you meet up with Lillian Leone? Because she's quite an amazing powerhouse of a vocalist. I mean, outside of maybe Doral Pesh, I can't think of any female vocalist who delivers that sort of dramatic assault with that kind of power and control. You know, it's usually more of a sweet soprano thing, or maybe like a Bonnie Raitt, Kim Carnes style blues thing, like Sandy Soraya or Lorraine Lewis from Femme Fatale, that kind of thing. Whereas
right.
She was doing this, you know, Ronnie James Dio, like, you know, just blasting away, and that's really rare. So how did you hook up with her?
Well, we were, you know, it did become sort of Dio, but we were shooting for Bon Scott. When Lois LaRue and I started Rude Girl,
right.
We actually had another bass player at the time named Star, we knew what we wanted. You know, we wanted that raw AC/DC vocal with
right.
The songs and the hooks of AC/DC, but with the groove and the sort of psychedelic dark feel of Black Sabbath.
Oh.
And so, you know, we put out flyers. And, you know, somehow Leather saw it. We auditioned, had to be over 100 vocalists.
Yeah.
And Lois is just super, super focused, and she'd be like, nope, nope, nope. I'm like, Lois, nope, nope, nope. Finally, I was like, nope, nope, nope. We just, we're not going to settle. We're either going to do this or we're not. And that's why I'm still with Leather today, because once we found her and she saw the flyer, she came into the audition, she sang a little bit. We said, hey, can you sing a little bit more gritty, like a, you know, like a Bon Scott kind of a thing? She said, well, I think so. And she turned around and she leaned down in the mic, and we started playing, I think, Rock and Roll by Zeppelin. She nailed it. She gave us that Leather that we hear today. And Lois and I stopped, and we looked at each other, and we were like, hang on 1 second. We went outside, and we're like, yeah! Yeah! We're like, yeah! Oh, my God! And it was like, oh, this has got to be destiny, you know? It's just glorious, because whoever... You're right. You nailed it. Whoever heard Leather before? There's no other Leathers.
I know, even today.
There's not. And once I had that, I got to tell you, when I didn't have it, I was a crab. I was cranky in every other band I was in. I swear. I finally ended up playing with a total hippie band with my friend Gary Hemsky for like 10 years when I was doing advertising. I would just record with him, and it was complete other side of the world hippie music, you know, singer-songwriter stuff. Because I just couldn't compromise. There's only one leather.
Yeah, true. Once you have the best, where are you going to go to?
Yeah.
I understand that Rude Girl were on the verge of inking a deal for a record, but the band fell apart before it could happen. So was there any material that was floating around out there that we can hear, or is it just all gone to time?
Well, nothing floating around because, like I said, the demos were few and far between. And there would have been Sandy Perlman, who was slated to be our producer, who was, you know, managing Black Sabbath, still has, if he has it, still has the 2-inch master of the soundtrack that we did. We were set up to record basics for the album at the Automat in San Francisco, which was a great studio at the time. And we did a sound check, and instead of stopping, typical of us, we just went through the whole set. So they recorded it on, at the time, 2-inch tape and gave us all cassette copies. That's about it. That's what you get. Other than the, I mean, I have some old 4-track stuff, and I have a lot of live shows at the Stone and the Boo Hay, and I have some where we're playing with opening for Megadeth. I've got a lot of that stuff. But instead of releasing that, we did do A Taste of Night, which is a Rude Girl song, and we put that on this first album. And we definitely have a plan in store for the Rude Girl material, big time, because everybody asks about it. And
yeah,
it's great, and it shouldn't die.
Yeah, because especially nowadays when everything seems to be coming out of the woodwork. I mean, even obscure bands that never really got signed, the demos are popping up, and, you know, the people are getting all this stuff out there. And it's like, you know, there aren't too many bands left that are like a legend. Like, oh, yeah, these girls were great, but I don't know. You can't hear it. So it's really, you know, it's fascinating to me that you're still there. And you're like, you're missing material out there somewhere.
Yeah, well, it will surface, definitely.
So after Levitt departed for what became an amazing 5 albums with Chastain and her solo record Shockwaves, you put together a new band, Malibu Barbie. Now, I only have the 12-inch from 87, which I've seen some people refer to as Rude Girls, but I don't think it actually had a title on it, which had Lords of the Night and When Lightning Strikes. And that was during Levitt's stint with Chastain, right around the same time as 7th and Never. But you got her on to do vocals, and you brought back Lois LaRue from Rude Girl on the solo for Lords of the Night. So it was pretty much a band reunion. How'd you work that one?
It was, sort of, except for the bass and the rhythm guitar, which I loved that bass player, Joanne Rebel. She was great, but we wouldn't, and the songwriting. I mean, neither of them were Rude Girl songs. So those two things, I wouldn't call it Rude Girl. The reason it is actually called Rude Girl is because Joanne was not mocking me, but in a funny way, she was sort of teasing me with the title, because I hated it when people called Rude Girl Rude Girls. And everybody knew, everybody in our circle knew I hated it. It was like, no, it's Rude Girl. It's a concept, not a group of girls, you know. So she purposely did that because she was pissed that I left town. I moved to L.A. to go to Musicians Institute. And the way that happened is we were recording tracks for Malibu Barbie, although I think it was called Chicken Ranch or something at the time, with Sylvia Massey, who, you know, went on to do Tool and Power Man 5000 and Move It Down. And we were recording tracks with her and auditioning vocalists, and decided we'll just bring them into the studio to audition them. You know, one thing led to another, and Leather got back in town. I called her up, and I was like, why don't you come in and just sing on this? She's like, I'm only here for a day or 2 days or whatever. I said, whatever, I'll pick you up. I don't even know the song. I'll pick you up. Don't worry. And I ended up, you know, singing it to her in her ear, basically, which still happens. We have a great relationship, so we kind of think the same. So sometimes we help each other with stuff. But, yeah, she came in and did it in, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 takes, typical Leather fashion. It sounded so good, and Sylvia was really good, and Joanne was helping to produce it, and she's got a great ear. We just thought, you know, it needed a lead guitar. And Kara Crash is actually on the picture on the back of the album.
Right.
Never played on it.
Really?
It was Lois. Yeah, she... she wanted her because she was in the later version of Malibu Barbie, so she put her picture on there, and again, I was out of town, so I was like, well, whatever.
So Lois is on both tracks.
Lois isn't. No, she only did. There's no lead on Lightning Strikes, right?
Okay, yeah.
No, she probably did the do. She might have done that, but it might have been Heidi, the rhythm guitar player, because it was just the tritone.
Right.
So on Lords, I called her up, and she was in town, and, you know, I was kind of surprised that she came in and did it. But she, Lois, is a master at hooks. That
right.
was her brilliance. And so she put the hook on Lords of the Night. Especially during the solo. And then Sylvia flew it into the beginning with, you know, her at the time taped wizardry.
Right.
And it just really all came together like that. It was just really, really super high qualified people doing their best work at the time.
You also put out a 3-song demo in 86 and an EP pretty late in the game for metal in the U.S. It was like 92, called Ain't Life Swell. And I understand that the demo actually breaks the pattern a bit. You actually had a male singer on that, Steve Gilardi?
The demo? Steve Gilardi was the original. Yeah, Malibu Barbie was a co-ed band at first. It was interesting. Joanne was from a band called Misconception.
Right.
And when Rude Girl broke up, we actually auditioned her to be the new bass player. But it didn't work out, but then Joel and I ended up playing together. I sort of joined her band, Misconception, with her and Heidi. Then we found a new guitar player, and that guy's name was Carrie Furr, and he brought in Steve Gilardi from a band called Righteous Sire. I don't think we were called Malibu Barbie. Carrie remembers all the names we were called, but we opened up for Paul Di'Anno's band,
right.
Stone. We played a lot of gigs, and it was total progressive metal at the time, which I loved. It was speed progressive metal. I mean, we had songs that were called like 6776 because that was the time signatures it was. And,
oh, nice.
And then we got, you know, Carrie left, the guy, and then we got Debbie Wolf from Leather Angel. Do you remember them?
Yes, I do.
And that was cool, and that was so close to an all-girl band that it kind of was weird. It was like the reverse. It was guy singer, all girls background, and it sounded good. It was okay. Just, I don't know. Steve reminded me the other day that the reason we didn't get signed as Malibu Barbie was with him was because he wouldn't shave his mustache. So I was like, are you serious? He's like, I'm so sorry for that. I'm like, I don't even remember that. I don't. All I remember was I was working out a lot because playing that was intense. I remember
right.
getting into really, you know, protein drinks and stuff.
I've actually heard the song Jealousy off of the EP, and it sounds very like early 80s punk rock in terms of the vocals, though the music is still metal. Was that a conscious approach since grunge and alternative were in full swing by then in 93?
Well, I left. So that was Joanne, the bass player. She decided to keep the name Malibu Barbie and get Cara back into the band, or finally into the band, which is why she had put her on the EP cover. So I really had nothing to do with that incarnation. But I guess they did well. It was, they were like a, Joe got into sort of Bauhaus, New Order,
right.
still had metal roots, and they were still, had been in Misconception, which was a metal band. But they had this guy named Smeg, who was from another popular band. So it was sort of, I don't know, what do you call it, dirty rock, drug rock, you know, not my style. And they
right.
went through drummers like water, apparently. They just couldn't keep them, or they died, or they fell off buildings. It was just obnoxious.
I'm not
kidding. Seriously, it was bad, yeah. Yeah, right, exactly, like Spinal Tap. I mean, it kept happening, you know. I was like, wow. So, yeah, that was not me.
So somewhere around this time, I understand you actually attended and graduated from Musicians Institute's PIT program for drummers, and that in itself is pretty damn impressive. So what led you to go do that?
I wanted to be in a really good band again. I didn't know how else to do that. It seemed like the scene in San Francisco, you know, I tried. I actually, at that time, and that was a long time ago, I did an Ozzy tribute band.
Right.
I was doing the first two albums, Randy Rose, and just me and a bass player. We never could find a guitar player, but that was a guy. And then I hooked up with this guy. Well, him and I just started songwriting. We were actually rehearsing right next to Death Angel. It was either Death Angel or Testament, and I jammed with those guys at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really a misogynist scene, and even though people would say to him, you know, whisper to him, man, she's really fucking good, it was, guys did not want to be doing speed metal or thrash metal with a girl drummer at that time. Now I think they do, you know.
Yeah,
now
it's cool, but back then it was still.
So, you know, Malibu Barbie falling apart, or maybe it was before Malibu Barbie, actually. I think it was. But Malibu Barbie, you know, couldn't make it. Debbie lived down in L.A., and we were going to move, and then the people said no, and I was like, well, what's going to happen with this band, you know? And again, no leather.
Right.
So I'm kind of grumpy and disgruntled. So I'm like, yeah, I have to try to get to the next level where there's going to be a good singer.
Right.
And I was given the opportunity to go to Musicians Institute. I moved from San Francisco within a week. I came down to L.A. and started the program. It was awesome. It was fantastic. Yeah.
Listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Sandy Sledge. In our next segment, we talk War Bride. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is James Murphy, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Stay classy, New York.
Hi, this is Golf Minister, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
To put some echo on that.
Hi, everyone. This is Nolan from Kryptos. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Was that good? Hi, everyone. This is Nolan Lewis from Kryptos, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi guys, this is Rohit here from Kryptos, and you're listening to Third Eye. Okay, I'll say that again. Okay. Hi, this is Rohit from Kryptos, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Yeah, Melon. Yeah, and all that cliche stuff.
And in our next segment, we talk Sandy's time with Laurie Lindstrith and War Bride, her venture into musicals, and the decline and fall of music in the USA, only here on Third Eye Cinema. But first, here's a song from another band Sandy was involved with. This is War Bride with The Tower.
We'll be right back.
Around the time you graduated, you joined another all-female band called War Bride with the very impressive guitarist Laurie Lindstrom from Jaded Lady, who was very much in the Yngwie school of playing. And this band was really her baby, so how did you get involved?
I was getting ready to graduate the year program, and I started accepting demos, you know, looking for bands, basically. One day, two of them were left for me at the front desk, and one of them was from a band called L7, and,
right.
which was a prominent punk band, and one of them was from this band called War Bride. And when I put the tape in and I heard Laurie's playing, it was like, oh, my God, this is the level that I want to be at. You know, again, I come from playing progressive. Remember, I was into Neil Peart, Carole Vollmer, and, you know, all this odd meter and stuff. And when I heard Yngwie, I just loved him, loved
right.
him. So when I heard her playing, I was like, oh, yeah. And that was it. Then, you know, I went and auditioned for him, and boom, it was like, it was a match made in heaven, except
yeah, was...
for the leader.
Okay.
Guess what happened?
Tell us about that.
Yes, it fucking got grumpy. No, it wasn't that I didn't like Nancy, who later changed her name to Ariel,
yeah,
or God, I can't remember. But yeah, and she was cool, and she had just broken up with Jeff Pilson, so, I mean, there were some contacts
right.
and stuff, and it wasn't that I didn't like her. She had a phenomenal voice, but it wasn't leather. Lori's playing was, so I kept saying to Lori, you know, let's get leather. You know, let's get leather. And I liked the bass player, Jana, who went on to play with Ron Keel in his all-girl incarnation.
Oh,
I loved her. As a person, she was wonderful. And as a solid bass player, she was great. But I really missed playing with Joanne, her
right.
style of playing. And I thought her and Lori and Leather and I, and
right.
a lawyer advised me at the time, if I could get all these people together, that he could get us a deal. So
right.
I went for it. And I pissed people off, you know. I went for it. I kept being like, you know, Lori, come on. You know, yeah, I like Nancy, but, you know, they're not signing us, and let's give this a shot.
Right.
But Leather was with Chastain, and so it was really hard to tie her down. And Lori kind of likes that operatic thing, really, did at the time. And Joanne was back and forth and didn't really get along with Lori. It was kind of weird. So I couldn't make that fucking fantastic all-girl band happen. It would have been amazing.
It's too bad because, you know, they actually put those three demos they did out. I think you were only involved with, what, two of them? You weren't on all three of the demos because one of them was when you're still in Melville Barbie, I think.
I know the song titles, I think, that I'm on. I know they called me in even after I was out of the band. They couldn't get a drummer to play right. And so she called me up. She said, would you, you know, I'm really sorry about everything, but would you play it? I'm like, sure. So I went
right.
in and played on that.
But, you know, those, it's too bad because you listen to this stuff, and first off, even though they tried to fix it up, it just being on tape, you know, being old demos, the sound's a little muddy. And, you know, what you're sitting there like, why the hell weren't these girls signed? I mean, the stuff is that good. And, you know, I've seen some footage of War Bride performing at Musicians Institute, and it was the lineup that had you and Rihanna on vocals, and it's really impressive, especially the one where they have you doing the tower, which I guess was like an unplanned encore or something, so the beginning gets cut off in the video I saw. So why do you think that the band never really did get that record deal? You know, was it just bad timing, or was it related to all these lineup changes, or what was going on?
I had just graduated from Musicians Institute, so I had contacts there that came and saw. There was this guy named Vic Trigger who worked A&R, and he came and saw us play it at Mates, which is a high-end rehearsal space,
right.
you know, and we were in top form, and he left without saying a word, you know, and later I sort of asked, and it was, you know, it was a combination of two things. It was one that, what I say in my bio, that Nirvana and those guys were becoming
yeah.
the new metal. You know, grunge
That's
was
true.
The new metal. But still, that didn't, and there's still metal in Europe. So the other only thing was that Nancy Rihanna couldn't lose enough weight. And, guys can be large, but girls, you know, we still can't. We're still not allowed to be large. And
right.
be lead singers. We have to be the sex thing.
Right.
So she was trying, but at the time, I guess they didn't have the... I don't know why she couldn't lose weight. Just lose the fucking weight. Jesus, it was a good band, and we had great songs, and we packed
yes.
the house when we played out here. We packed it. We played with World War III all the time. And just, you know, fuck, pisses me off, because
yeah.
that was a great band. That was
really
great
was.
Music. Laurie Lindstrom, like, what a fucking talent. Oh, my God.
And yet
what
I understand.
The hell?
I understand she gave up the guitar. I'm like, what? Why?
She's uninspired. Don't think I'm not still trying to get her. I am. Believe me. I'm like, Lori, got leather, come on.
That would be so great, especially with leather now.
And, you know, and she, but again, she liked that operatic vocal thing, but still, you know, Lori, but she just got, I think, you know, she tried so hard and kept trying, and she just burnt out. You know, after you try for, what, 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And nothing happens, and you got to start selling your freaking guitars.
Yep.
What the hell? How is that okay? You know, it's, I'm sure there's a lot of guys out there that that happens to. But she was outstanding.
Yeah, it's really just a shame. That's why I ask these questions, like, what the hell? Why not? You know,
bugger, though. Go bugger. Write her emails. Track her down, write her emails, and say, why aren't you playing with Sledge Leather? Why aren't
you
playing with Sledge
Leather?
And
any listeners out there, you know, that's familiar with Warbride, you've got to go do this. You know, email Lori and see if you can get her to Sledge Leather. Because that would be something.
Seriously.
Else. That would be amazing.
She's amazing. I mean, her playing is just beautiful. You know, she took what Yngwie and Uli Roth did.
Yep.
And she sort of married the two of them and her delicacy on the fretboard and accuracy.
It was more melodic than Yngwie. It had more of a, like you said, like an old John Roth approach to it. So after Rude Girl, Malibu Barbie, and Warbride, you dropped out of metal and got involved in musicals for a bit? Tell us about that. It's a bit unusual to hear from someone in the metal scene that they got involved in that sort of background.
Well, I learned how to read music at Musicians Institute, and I was on the, you know, still looking for work, and they called me one day after I graduated. I think this was way after Warbride, and they said, you know, there's a weird thing. It's a musical, and I wasn't doing anything that day, whatever, so I'm like, well, now let me check it out.
Right.
And I went down and just started having fun again. You know, fun playing music. And maybe that's what Lori didn't get. Maybe that's what saved my ass. Because, you know, we were frustrated. All
right.
Leather, too. Hello, Leather. Hello. Talk about dropping out of the scene.
Yep.
You know?
20 years.
It's, you know, what happens is we get discouraged. You kick us for so long, and we're not going to get back up. We're just going
to
be like, fuck it.
You don't
and
have
is
to
that
fuck
really
me.
What you guys
myself.
Want? Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I didn't play for like
and
10
some
years.
people say, well, you know, only the good people rise to the top and stuff.
No, that's not true. That's not true.
You know, I haven't found that to be true at all.
No.
No.
So, yeah, I totally understand what you're talking about there.
I think I got saved. I got saved, you know, by doing musicals, and they were easy and funny, and because most of them are like musical comedy, and the people in it were so light and frivolous, and it was way different than the metal scene, and they didn't blink an eye that I was a girl. They didn't care, just as long as I could play it. And you know what? I took all my metal drama and passion, because you know metal.
Yeah.
It's dramatic. I
yes,
mean,
it
it's theater. It is total theater. So I was perfect for it. You know, I had, you know, big crescending, you know, and you could play fast in those things. There's some musicals that are really challenging and fun. And so that's what I did. I brought me into musicals, and they loved me. So I worked, I just kept getting work over and over and over and over, consistent work, and I didn't even have to look for it. And finally, some success in music.
Right. So you and Leather remain in contact throughout, and I understand you were chasing after her to get back together for a while. So how did you finally get her to do it? Was it really just Ronnie's passing that flipped the switch?
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was. We were sitting there, you know, I'm sure she told the story. We were sitting there in the blazing hot sun in May, and there was what we call the moment. I mean, because I'd been after her for, you can imagine how long.
Yeah, sure.
And it was, you know, she made the mistake of not seeing Ronnie with me. And that what turned out to be his last show in L.A. And almost his last show. I think he did one or two more shows in England after that. But
right.
We saw him with Heaven and Hell. I saw him
right.
with Heaven and Hell. And, you know, it was, I called her up afterwards, and I'm just blabbering on the phone. Oh, my God, you should have seen it. It was amazing. He was so amazing. He didn't drop a beat. It was, you know, just,
right.
like, filled with all that stuff, all that inspiration that we get filled with. And she's like, damn it, why didn't I go? And I can't believe it. And now I missed the one up here. And next time, we're like, next time for sure. And then it happened, and we found out that he had cancer. She texted me one day, and I said, let's go see it. Let's go visit him in the hospital. And she said, he's in Texas. And then before you know it, you know, she called me, and actually Lois LaRue called me on the other line while I was talking to Leather. She said, you know, he died. Lois called on the other line and said, you know, Ronnie's Dio's dead. So it wasn't just me and Leather. It was the Rude Girl thing. Yeah, it was the Rude Girl thing. And why does it take that? Yeah. I don't know. And Mo is still a shied away. You know, she was back for a minute, and now she's completely like, nope. You know, not going to play music. There's another one. Hello, talent. When you hear the Rude Girl songs, I mean, do you like Taste of Night? When you hear the Rude Girl song, or the Gallows off of the Keep It True festival that we played, the Rude Girl epic song that Ronnie James Dio loved. I mean, there's, you know, another talent who got, whatever, discouraged. So I'm waiting for her to come back. I mean, ideally, Lori, Lois, me, Leather, and you know, Jimmy Bain. but if not Jimmy Bain, I like Betsy from who played with us at Keep It True. She's a great bass player.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that it takes things like this because, you know, a lot of fans, myself included, obviously, have really been hoping for Leather to reappear for all these years, particularly since, you know, we've got this recent revival of respect for the 80s metal scene. So, you know, just having this happen was a really welcome surprise, even though it kind of fell on the back of something that was like, oh, man, you know, we lost another one, especially somebody as big as Ronnie. So
yeah.
How are you finding your return to metal? Are you surprised at how much of the audience isn't even necessarily the older fans like myself, but this new generation who essentially discovered, you know, real metal via the internet?
I guess at first, yeah, when I started doing a Google search for Leather's name and found the Facebook page with all those fans on it and found all those YouTube, you know, 74,000 hits on her For Those Who Dare video on YouTube at the time. And I was like, what the fuck? And I read the comments. And then I put, you know, a Warbride thing or two up, and then, you know, people were flocking to that. And I was like, wow. And then, I mean, I knew, Joanne told me that the Malibu Barbie record sold. And I was like, come on. And I put one on eBay, and it went up to, like, $78. I was like, what? There's two songs on this thing. What? And then I did searches on the internet for that, and I was like, whoa. Yeah, I guess I was surprised. It's like probably about 5 years ago now, so I kind of forgot. But I was surprised as hell.
So are there any thoughts, you know, as to why it took so many years for metal to regain the respect that it used to have in this country? Because, you know, like you said earlier, it never really died in Europe. It never really died in Japan. But the U.S. has been a real musical wasteland since around 1991 because of, you know, grunge and that hip-hop taking over. And it kind of dumbed down the whole field of music, per se. So you have any thoughts on why this might be? And like, despite the fact that it is making a real comeback worldwide, here in the States it's still more of a culty thing. Well, we still got all this garbage filling the airwaves and the record companies are putting out there.
I laugh because people would say that metal is dumbing down stuff, you know. But hip-hop, you know, I could talk like for an hour about the state of the industry. But I guess, you know, long story short, money and population growth. You know, does that sound weird? Gosh, I got opinions, but I think I'd get in trouble, like, for the reasons, the real reasons. I mean, let's just put it this way. The people are behind hip-hop, and there's nothing wrong with hip-hop. The people behind hip-hop have a lot more influence, economic influence, than the people behind metal.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
That's true.
Economic influence in this country. I mean, we're a company. We're not really a country, right? We're a company where you're, you know, sort of supposed to climb your way to the top. And for good or for bad, I mean, that's what America is. You know, go take your claim, in my opinion, anyway.
Funny how you were saying, like, about how some people might say, oh, yeah, metal's dumbing it down. When you think about it, that statement's kind of silly because I listen to all kinds of music. And really the only stuff you could say is like, okay, well, this is better, you know, musical. You have to have more skill. You have to have more knowledge or whatever to play this would be jazz. Or I wouldn't even say classical because you're really just playing somebody else's music that's been dead for 100 years. But when you're creating something like that, you know, like, okay, I'm making my own classical piece or I am composing for a soundtrack or something like that. Okay, yeah. You could say that's more whatever than metal, but if you compare it to, like, you know, new wave or, you know, hip-hop or grunge or alternative, you know, these people know, like, three chords, and that's kind of it, if they know that. You know, the guy's doing it on the computer, and it's just kind of like, you know, the industrial music where they're making sound effects, dance music. You know, this stuff is not on the same level. We're not talking about you've got to have some sort of a skill to do this. It's just like, you know, anybody can roll out of bed and do it, more or less. Be able to rhyme, and there you go.
Yeah, well, I think they would probably disagree with you.
Well, I'm sure, but...
on the basis that not everybody can do it, not everybody can get popular. But again, I think it's economically driven, and who gets popular and whatnot is, and I'm probably going to get killed for this, kind of money has to go through the system somewhere.
Yeah.
Certain money has to go through the system, and it's not maybe always the most legal money. And so it has to get put through the washer and the dryer. And, you know, I think music is a really good place for that to go. So I'm going to die. I know this.
I wonder if I should edit that part.
But, you know, I don't care. I mean, fucking whatever. I think it's the truth. And, you know, you don't have a lot of that in metal. People are, whether they're stoners maybe a little bit, or there's not a whole lot of big money there. So
sure.
I think all music, I mean, you know, to be honest with you, when I was doing advertising, or I was doing radio commercials, really, and I was doing comedy radio commercials because that's the only way I could reconcile doing advertising. I
right.
felt like, you know, kind of bad, but I was making people laugh. But we would use music in the background, and the music that you use is called needle drop music or production music. And it really opened my eyes. I don't know if you're interested in this or not, but I'll tell you, keep short, it really opened my eyes to what really music is and how it really depends upon the instrumentation. And if you're going to, it's the same notes, really, and a lot of the same rhythms and a lot of the same chord structures. And if you put a distortion pedal or put it through a Marshall, then it becomes one thing. And if you put it clean through a jangly amp, you know, it becomes another thing. And if you play it slow, it's one thing. But a lot of it, I mean, if you're making music, you sort of can make it in any style just with the right instrumentation. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that in America it's dictated by the economy, because, again, we're driven by economy, and what makes money, or where money is put, is what's going to sell or what's going to be used to generate more money.
Unfortunately, true.
I mean, with the exception of people like Lori or Lather, or people who are like virtuosos in a certain style.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Sandy Sledge. In our last segment, we'll be talking Sledge Leather, what art means, and we get serious. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Enjoy the day.
This is Sam Rosenthal of Black Tip Flu. You're not recording this, are you? Okay. This is Sam Rosenthal of Black Tape for a Blue Girl, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, this is Davey Vane from Vane. I want you to get very close to your speakers right now, right up against your speakers, because you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
And as I said during the break, in our last segment, we'll be talking Sledge Leather, what art means, and we're getting serious. So here we go. Let's talk Sledge Leather, because I assumed that you were more responsible for the music while Leather was handling the lyrics, but she had indicated that you really handled both ends of the equation for most of this record.
This is, no, she said that, but she's probably just being, I don't know, that... You got me there, because I can't think of the right word. And what I want to say is it's a collaboration. I feed off of her, and she feeds off of me, for sure.
Right.
We're so happy to be back doing what we were supposed to be doing. And we've got so much of the same ideas, the same ways of looking at things. And I have a lot of writing skills from my years of writing. I was an English major in college, and years of punching up, what they call punching up or touching up, griffs. I'm very fast. I can take the idea, because I mean, I have thousands of scripts I've punched up, and you have to, you learn to do it quick. So I can take the idea, I can see what somebody's trying to talk about, and shape it into the rhythm structure that it needs to be, for the melodic structure. So I do that a lot with her lyrics, and then I'll add or take away or whatever some of my ideas. And then occasionally some songs will just come to me. I'll just be doing something, and I'll get inspired by something, and a whole song will just come out of me, and I'll sing it into my iPhone, and I'll play it for her and say, what do you think? And that's a couple of the songs, like Imagine Me Alive and Lost Forgiveness.
So you actually have compositional skills as well as drumming technique, from what you're saying. And that's not something you hear from a lot of drummers out there. That's pretty impressive in itself.
Thanks. I play piano. I started playing piano after I got out of Musicians Institute, because I moved into a place that had a piano. Something I wanted to do since I was a kid. And the stuff that I learned at Musicians Institute, at the time, the school was amazing. And we had just the highest-end instructors, and it was a really hard program. So the stuff that they taught there sort of applied to, and piano's a percussion instrument, applied to other instruments. So I took the knowledge, put it into piano, and just started writing songs. So, yeah, I've been composing for a long time.
I asked Leather some of these questions as well, obviously, but it might make sense to run them by you, since she seemed to indicate that you're responsible for the music and most of the lyrics as well. So what is the title Imagine Me Alive really referring to? Because I was wondering if it was a statement of surprise that you're both still here with us and back on the scene, or is there any sort of deeper meaning to it?
It's all kinds of stuff, isn't it? And that's one of the ones that just came to me. I was inspired by Rev from Avenged Sevenfold, who had already passed away, actually. I don't know where it came from, to be honest with you. It's just one of those things. I sang it into my iPhone. The story goes, I was giving my dog a bath.
Right.
And after I was done, I was sitting down, relaxing for a minute while she was drying, and the song came out of me. I had been listening to Avenged Sevenfold, to the Nightmare record. I don't know. Imagine Me Alive. I've never said that before. I said to Leather the other day, I called her up and I was like, where did that come from? Who says Imagine Me Alive? What is that? You know, I was kind of happy because I've always wanted to come up with something cool. I think it's kind of cool. We took it to mean a spirit who is, this is the concept of the album, a spirit who is looking back on all their lives, is able to comprehend the different time periods that it was alive. And saying, I am not here now, but imagine me alive. Here was some of the ways that I lived my life. And I think that that's going to continue with Leather and I. That's going to be a through line through every CD that we put out.
I understand that in your current tour, you're covering songs that span both your and Leather's careers. We're talking about Rude Girl stuff, Malibu Barbie stuff, Chastain stuff. I don't think you're doing any War Bride songs, but even so, I find this pretty refreshing because a lot of bands and musicians tend to just focus on the current album or project and just kind of like poo-poo the material that brought them here. It's almost like you're denying you had a past, and it's kind of inauthentic. I always find it better when someone can acknowledge and salute their past and then continue to move on with the future. Like, yeah, this is who we were, this is who we are now, and everyone can see how well the material fits into their repertoire and just kind of assess the person and their creative output as a whole instead of picking little chunks like, oh, I only liked you back in 82 or something. You know, that seems much more limiting to me, you know, especially if there's some sort of progression where there's any kind of relation between where you were then and where you are now. So tell us about this aspect of it, because it's not something you hear all the time.
I agree with you. And fortunately, and it took Leather a little bit, but fortunately she sees your point too. You know, she sees that idea. And I don't know why you would just dismiss the past. And especially, you know, I liked some of the material, but why would I not want to play it?
Exactly. I've always found that kind of baffling, though a lot of people do that. So it's nice to hear that you guys were going back and doing the old stuff. I'm like, oh, cool. Okay, when you come around here?
Which, besides, nobody got to hear it then, too. So, I mean, you know, in a way, it's almost new. And, you know, some of those songs, I don't want them to die. I wish that Lori would come back. And, again, if anybody's listening, please harass her. tell her Sledge sent you. Because some of her material was fucking great, and it would be amazing. I asked her for a ballad, actually, for the last record.
Right.
And she was, you know, hemming and hawing, oh, I don't know, I don't really. She's one of those who doesn't want to dredge up the past. Maybe it's painful. It's not painful to me. I mean, I wrote One Glimpse probably, you know, 20 years ago, and that's the ballad on her album, and it wasn't painful. I will say that Scared of Heights, the song that I told you about in the beginning, that's for Delphine.
Right.
I actually physically get, like, sick to my stomach when I play it. We're going to put it on the record, but it does make me, like, ill. It's weird.
That just says how powerful it is, you know, that really affects you. You know, you actually threw something into it. And again, we're talking about being authentic, whereas you accept where you were, and you here you are now, and this is who I was and who I am, and accept it. Here it is. As opposed to just, you know, pretending you're just something, you just sprung up like a newborn baby or something. And it's the same thing here. You're actually not just throwing down, okay, here, let me throw out something I think is going to sell or sounds cool, let's throw with the devil or some crap, like some bands will do. And, you know, you're actually putting something out there of yourself. You know, you're throwing a piece of your heart, your soul, your life, you know, you're expressing something that's close to you. And yeah, sometimes it hurts, but that's what makes it special. You know, that's what makes art.
That is what makes art, isn't it? That's for sure.
Now, the new material is a bit more modernistic than what you guys were doing back in the 80s, but Lev is really looking at sounding great. It's like she never left the scene, and you're drumming, you know, with the sort of Pro Tools mix that you've been using now, the drums are more or less front and center as well, so we actually get to hear how good you are. It's not buried in the mix.
Thank you.
Were you influenced at all? I mean, you mentioned some of the great drummers that you started off trying to learn. Were you influenced at all by any of the great female drummers? Like, you know, I mentioned Sandy West from the Runaways, or, you know, later on we had Linda McDonald from Phantom Blue. Or do you just pull influences from all over? Because I had mentioned her early on, but it really does bother me how Sandy West kind of gets glossed over when people talk about the Runaways, given how good she really was.
And, you know, I ran into someone at a party who knew her, and a friend of mine said, oh, Sandy's a drummer too, and this girl took me by the shoulders and looked me in the eyes, and she said, please don't quit. Sandy regretted quitting so much, and she was, like, crying.
Wow.
And looking at me. And that was, this is before we did Sledge Leather. It really affected me. So, I mean, other than Sandy, and I do kind of feel like I had a fucking torch to carry, because she had a rocky road, man. Oh, God.
Yeah, very much so.
Linda from Phantom Blue is now in Iron Maidens, of course. So she's doing great. I've seen them a couple times here in L.A. She's great. It's an inspiration to see her up there. And I think that they have an original band, but I haven't seen that. There's this jazz drummer, Terry Lynn Carrington. Glad she's out there. She's amazing for jazz.
Right.
But inspiring, no. I'm inspired by Danny Carey of Tool. And this last record that we just did, I said to our engineer, can you please make the bass drums sound like this? So that it's out there and prominent, because, you know, I want to be heard.
And
I've been playing drums for a long time. I want to be heard. So yeah, that and that production and that off of 10,000 Days specifically. I didn't love the rest of the albums except for Undertow. I loved, but
right.
The 10,000 Days, which came out like 5 years ago, just loved everything about it. Really.
So why all the short interludes on the album? Because if you include Torch for its brevity, there's 5 in all out of 11 tracks. It's almost like an EP in effect.
It is. How about that? Well, all of a sudden the tracks were numbered and it was 11 and it came in as a regular album. And so it was put out. I got to tell you, it sort of hit us by surprise. It was like over 30 minutes and it was 11 tracks and weird kind of loophole with iTunes that if it's 11 tracks or over, then it's an album and not an EP. So there it went. Album.
Okay, that explains it then.
That's pretty much what people were pissed, though. People were pissed. In the reviews, the only bad thing we get is, well, it wasn't long enough, which is a great bad thing to get. You know, we're
right.
Inspired.
It means you want more, right?
Yeah.
But what led to all the interludes in the first place? Why did you choose to put so many of these little, almost like mood pieces between?
To piss people off. I have a mean streak still. No, because they belong there. Because it's a story. They're part of the story. The little pieces are part of the story. This next one is actually going to be way more involved with that kind of stuff. I want to give people, and it's going to be like watching a movie. You know, I want to give people a full media experience. Why not?
Yeah, and it does come off that way. It is an album that works as a whole. You know, there's an atmosphere and a mood going on as opposed to just, let me pick out track 3, 5, and 7 or something.
Yeah.
Again, this is something I spoke about a bit with Leather, and she had a very different interpretation on some of this. But I noticed a very strong focus on religion on this record. I mean, the guy upstairs lied, her father's daughter. So what inspired you to adopt such a strong focus in this area on what amounts to the comeback record for both of you in metal terms?
Love is a Catholic. She's like a born, not a born again. She's like a, she's not
Italian
a born
Catholic.
Again at all. Italian Catholic, right, exactly.
That's what I picked up with her, but she was saying, no, 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 it might be there, but I'm really thinking of this and that, so I want to see what you thought.
Then I'll let her just take that. I mean, I'm not religious at all, but I am humorous and,
right.
you know, kind of devilish in that respect. I really like comedy, and Leather's really funny, too. I mean, we crack each other up. So a lot of stuff might be tongue-in-cheek, and it might not be. I mean, it's a little bit of both. You know, the guy upstairs lied is obviously innuendo. It has double meaning. That's us. We're like that. We're fucking stupid heavy, disgustingly deep, serious. And then we crack up. We watch Saturday Night Live together. You know, we crack up. We watch comedies. We make each other laugh all the time. Because it's a big fucking cosmic joke. If I didn't get to the point, and Leather super healthy, like you wouldn't believe, and if I hadn't gotten to this point where I took everything with a grain of salt and a huge pinch of humor,
right.
I would have bought the casket. I would have had to have, because there's just, it's frustrating. I mean,
yeah.
Like we talked about. So that's what you get with Sledge Leather, you know, you get innuendo and double meanings, and we want you to, you know, we want you to chuckle, but we're also being really deadly serious in a lot of it. Deadly fucking serious.
Because I was picking that up, and she told me something that related to some guy that was a tenant upstairs, and he was just like an asshole.
So, is he an asshole?
I
wonder. Is the guy upstairs an asshole? I don't know. Is there a guy upstairs or is it a girl upstairs? Is anybody up there? I don't know.
But she wasn't even taken on that level. She's like, oh no, it's just some tenant upstairs. I'm like, okay. I'm either
more
overreading
will be
this
revealed.
Earlier.
All I can tell you is that more will be revealed. Did she talk to you at all about the next album? And
not
like,
in the least. Just said you were doing one. That was all.
It's going to be a lot about what we went through. Talk about going into the past. It's going to be a lot about what we went through in Rude Girl and her Chastain stuff and my Malibu Barbie stuff and our lives. It's going to be heavy, but we're always going to try to be a little comical.
You also have a strong focus on mortality with A Taste of Night. You know, Before Eternal Sleep, The Moments Are So Brief. It's strange. It's strange how in your teens, everyone seems to be in love with the idea of death or whatever, and we're all thinking about it so much. But, you know, as you get older and you get on in life, it gets more scary and real because now you develop friendships and love lives and families, and all of a sudden you got something to lose. But, again, she told me something about, like, cruising the streets back in the 80s. So I'm like, wait a minute, what's really going on here? How am I reading this stuff into this?
I know that it cracks me up, and I don't correct her on that because we, Leather and I wrote part of that song, and Lois LaRue wrote part of that song. The lyrics, we
right.
all wrote the music. Before Eternal Sleep, The Moments Are So Brief was straight up Lois. How I Get a Taste of You, The Taste of Night was about us practicing our rehearsal spaces on Haight Street.
Right.
And we would come up at 3 in the morning after rehearsal and, you know, sort of empty streets, but sort of like the derelicts of the world on the street. And the fog would be rolling in and we would be still keyed up from rehearsal. And we would just walk around and, like, we owned the streets. It was a trip, you know, these three girls, sometimes with our bass player, three
right.
girls in, you know, black leather with, and we got in some trouble too out there, you know, but we were just kind of fearless. It was
yep.
weird because it was, you're going to hear more about it, definitely. It was a fucking intense time. It was amazing. But the super heavy stuff in the front part of that song is Lois was very, very heavy and spiritual and very into, not witchcraft necessarily, but I do believe that a lot of the Rude Girl songs were spells. And it took me a long time to realize that. I had to go out into the desert myself just like 10 years ago, and I kind of had this thing that I did. And kind of like Jim Morrison used to do. And I realized that the songs, the Rude Girl songs, were spells. And a lot of that came from Lois. And Leather and I just sort of ate it up. We loved it. I think we carry that forward.
And then after that song, If Isn't the One Glimpse, which seems to be about encountering ghosts, which she didn't correct me on.
Yeah.
Where does all this stuff come from? Was it really just this whole concept that you were talking about?
It is, because it's not like I sat down to write a story, or that we sat down and thought, okay, let's invent characters. This is us. This was our life. This is continuing to be our lives. These strange things, these hauntings, these communications from other places, these spells, these weird coincidences running into Jimmy Bain in the grocery store. After I had just said to the guitar player, we need to find Jimmy Bain. I don't want to make phone calls, though, because I got to call some people I don't want to talk to.
Right.
Oh, damn it. But we need milk. I went into the store, and I swear to God, I'm like, oh, my God, Jimmy Bain is in the freaking cheese section. Like, I'm not kidding you. And I mean, right? And so that kind of stuff, that's our life. That's not our entire life, but that's one huge part of our life. And that's where the stuff comes from. It's from reality. I'm not making it up. The guy upstairs, that just happened.
So, you know, apropos the sort of morbid introspection that I'm getting at here that seems to be going on the record, you utilize a lot of dreamy gothic-style delay effects. You got whispers, voices and guitars fading in and out, volume swells, phase effects. It's very creepy, and it sets this kind of claustrophobic mood that the material seems to be reaching for, especially lyrically. Was this all very deliberate? Did you have this whole thing planned, or was it just you found your way as you went along as you got more and more songs and just built from there?
Yeah, I would say it's the latter. We built it from there. They started to, you know, had songwriting sessions. And Leather and I are very much alike. When you get us with anybody else, and at the time it was Matthias, our guitar player from Germany, we had a lot to say. Don't forget, Ronnie had just died. That's what brought it together. So to think that it wouldn't be ghosty and wispy and heavy and kind of, you know, creepy like that would have been completely uncharacteristic. And that's what I wanted to bring Leather back to be honest with you, because I didn't feel like that was Root Girl. Root Girl, you know, we took the elements that we were living in and we put them into the music, and we were Root Girl. That's why it wasn't Root Girls. It was a concept. We were Root Girl. We were ripped up shirts, black leather. Sometimes we get mean. Sometimes we get rowdy. But this is it. We're living it. This isn't an act. And same thing with this. Ronnie had died. Leather decides to come back. Well, what do you think? It's going to be heavy. It's fucking emotional. She loved Ronnie James Dio. He was her vocal reason. I love Ronnie too, but he's brokenhearted. Brokenhearted that he died. And that's what you get.
So the Lost Forgiveness, you know, that track in particular felt very dramatic in the Dio or Iron Maiden sense. And what's surprising about it is that it seemed like it would be a long track, but you'd very consciously chosen to keep all your songs fairly brief, almost like they were crafted specifically for radio airplay. So was that deliberate?
No, that wasn't deliberate. That was a source of a victim of circumstance. I hate to say victim, but it was more circumstance. And, you know, Lost Forgiveness probably could have been a lot longer.
Yeah, because it felt like it was going to be. And then I was like, well, that was really short. Okay.
I love that song. I'm so glad you brought it up. You know, that song, I had told Leather I had gone to Germany a few years ago with my parents, and I was really affected by the heaviness I felt in the air and everything that you read. I mean, everywhere is monuments to, you know, we killed, you know, these Jews died because we burned the church down. Here the Jews were that we took off to, you know, the Holocaust. Here's the black people that we took off to the Holocaust. The gays all died here. I mean, it's all over. And it's like, fuck. And then I went to Prague, and it was there too. Everything in Prague, it's a gorgeous city. All their monuments, and it's, you know, saints will kill you, you know, if you mess with us. Even the sewer covers is like a sword coming out behind a shield, like, we're going to kill you if you mess with us. I was like, Jesus Christ, you guys, this is heavy. This is so heavy. And I just couldn't, I just thought, you know, it's the lost forgiveness. It's like, you can't forgive everything that happened. It's way too late to forgive all that. It happened, and they're still talking about it. They're still putting up monuments. It's still everywhere. It's like, stop. Let's move on. It's a lost forgiveness. You can't get that back. You have to, you know, refocus.
Yeah.
And
it's a touchy subject with a lot of people, and it's, you know, it's hard to really play into that. But it's true just in general in life that even when something really horrible happens that you really have no control over and it just kind of is forced on you, at some point in your life, if you were going to live, if you're not just going to be consumed by it, you have to, I don't know, how you can say make peace or something like that, but you've got to be able to move on and get past it and, you know, not be totally focused on it 24/7. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that are still consumed by it to that extent. I mean, it's not something we should ever forget. That's not the issue at all. It's just we're talking about you know, just for your own well-being, you've got to kind of put it down to a certain level. Like, all right, yes, it's there, and, you know, it is what it is, but, you know, I have to personally be able to live my life. Yeah. So I hear exactly what you're saying there about that.
I had to learn that, too, in my own little heartbreaks. I mean, certainly nothing, you know, happened to me like the Holocaust, but, you know, going through music, the music industry was so hard. And I could have kept that anger moving forward like Sandy West, I think, did. She just never let go of it.
Yeah.
Let it, you don't, it, it's not that you let go, because it doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
But it you can reconcile it. And
yes.
In AA, they call it a fourth step. What you do is you look at your part. What was my part of this? And no, those people didn't have a part in the Holocaust. Of course
right.
not. You know, but what was my part in the music industry? Okay, where was I trying to be selfish into getting my agenda put forward? Where was I feeling like a victim of circumstance, and so I stopped trying? You know, I dropped
right.
out. Things like that.
Right.
And that going through that process gets you to a point where it's not about letting go. It's about going, okay, this happened.
Right.
And yeah, it affected me. But I'm not going to stop. I'm going
right.
to dig in, and I'm going to try harder.
That's exactly what I was trying to get at. It's not letting go and forgiving. It's moving on, saying, okay, I'm not going to stop dead here. I've got a trail to keep walking despite what's going on and what happened. And, you know, maybe I'll carry that with me for the rest of my life, but I'm not going to stop. So
right.
exactly what you're saying.
And I would have liked boss forgiveness to be a little bit longer, but we, it's budget and things like that, and it just sort of ended. The song sort of ended. seemed like an okay ending to me.
No, it definitely worked. It was just, like I said, I was in such a dramatic build, and I was expecting it to be, you know, a 6-minute, 12-minute song, like Iron Maiden length. And I was just like, okay, well, it was like 4 minutes. Wow, that's strange. Okay. Another thing, on a lighter note now, that struck me.
I totally agree. Totally agree. You want to be in the band?
I would love to, sure. You need a lead guitar player? I'm here. Another thing that struck me odd about the record, beyond all the interludes and its overall brevity, is while I hear a lot of European neoclassical inflected guitar fills throughout the album, I don't think there were any proper solos outside of The Man Upstairs Lied. And I understand from whether this was actually a conscious and deliberate decision.
Did she say that? What I remember is that Matt, the guitarist, we sort of had to push him. He's great player, but
yeah.
we sort of had to push him to do a solo. He just, I don't know, he just, you know, he was real stressed at the time. He had moved here, and then that's part of the reason for the brevity of stuff, because he'd moved here and couldn't really get employment, and we weren't picked up by a label at the time, and money's an issue. So I think that had something to do with it. I don't know. I would ask Leather again about that, because, I mean, we wanted more guitar solos. But
okay, she was saying that was more of like a deliberate thing, at least on his part. Like, that's his style. And
on
was
his
like, well,
part, yeah.
Yeah, because you know, he's
part.
A good player. You can hear it. And yet, it's like, well, there's really
yeah.
no solos. Why? You know, the guy can obviously play.
Exactly. Deliberate on his part, not our part. Because we were like, come on, Matt. And we actually had to push him into doing the solos that he did.
Yeah.
Maybe he was nervous. You know, probably coming off of, when, oh, I'm going to be compared to Chastain. Probably
right.
nervous. Probably
that's
nervous.
True.
I don't know. He would probably say not. No,
but
I was not nervous. He would laugh.
But again, this is a very impressive record overall, and all the old fans are both
thank
a bit
you.
Shocked and very pleased to know that you and Leather are looking and sounding just as good as ever. It's surprising that nothing really seems to have changed after such a long break from performance, at least on her end. You're primarily selling this one direct. It's self-released, right? So why
yeah.
choose to go that route rather than working through the usual channels?
I have to be honest with you, Gene, and that's what we're looking at now. With this, if there's any delay in the next record, it's not because it's not written. It's not because we can't play it. It's because we have a lack of funds, and we might have to, you know, call out to the fans to, you know, do some kind of a Kickstarter thing or whatever, some kind of campaign to get the record made. Because Leather and I don't know that we can finance this one and have it be as long as everybody wants it to be, and we want it to be. We have a lot to say. Most of the songs are written, but, you know, we need to spend money on production, and we're going to need some help. We don't have a label. You know, Metal Up is our label, and it's, you know, Leather and I financed the last one out of love and really, you know, a tribute to Ronnie, who said
Ronnie.
To her, just never stop, never stop. But money's tight, G. teaching.
Yeah.
I don't get why we didn't get picked up by a label. Is it age?
I have no idea. I think it's just this country. You know, maybe if you're working.
Well, the labels in Europe didn't. Nobody, you know, we talked
really?
To AFM. AFM said you guys are great, but it would take too long to break a new band in America. Steamhammer, who am I thinking of? Steamhammer, which is a small subsidiary of a much bigger company. Century Media passed. Roadrunner definitely passed. Metal Blade not only passed, but was rude about it. No pun intended. Yeah, they sent us a form letter. We're like, wow, really? A form letter. Thank you for your submission to Metal Blade. We're like, what the fuck? No, but when we were 20, you guys were dying for us.
Wow.
So what? Again, it's not that we're too fat. Is it? You know, is it age? I don't know. Lots of metal fans are out. Lamb of God, aren't they all? Aren't we all older now? I mean, I don't fucking know. And it's really depressing. It's frustrating. Don't let me get frustrated again. You know, like don't let Weather get frustrated again because we'll lose her.
Yeah,
she's got a short fuse. That one.
Do you actually have something like a Kickstarter set up already, or is it just, you know, you're thinking about it?
We don't. I'm thinking about it, and I've been told, be careful with Kickstarter because they'll take your money, and then there's all kinds of restrictions and stuff. So I'm thinking, all right, so what am I going to do? Just put it on Facebook? You guys want to send us some fucking money? I mean, it's so cheesy, right?
Yeah, it is kind of tacky, but you know, what you got to do what you got to do. It's, you know, you want to get something out there. Wow. So on that note, I mean, do you have anything you want to plug, you know, any upcoming tours, or did you want to point the listeners to your website or Facebook page?
Sure. Now, Leather did it, didn't she? Let her do it. Because, okay. Now I'm thinking about money and budget because I'm the money person, and now I'm like, God, I don't want to come off as negative, you know, I need to be positive.
Yeah.
But honestly, you know, you can tell your listeners that we're going to need help with the next record. And I didn't tell Leather that I was going to say this, and
right.
I don't know what she's going to say about it. You know, she's got a good amount of pride, but we're going to need some help. I mean, we have some money from the last record. Everything that we sell goes right back into, you know,
right.
after paying for costs and stuff. And, I mean, Jimmy Bain doesn't just show up. They need some compensation just to pay their bills and then the production, you know. That's just so people, you know, I don't know. But again,
right.
if there's a record label out there, I mean, the record's going to be fucking phenomenal. I'm going to tell you right now, because Leather's in better shape than ever. We
right.
have a great relationship with the engineer. If you liked the production on the last one, you know, it's going to be the same team. We have another guitar player now who's just graduating from Musicians Institute. He brings a great, exciting edge and great player and interpreter of our music. And I've got some surprises in store. For how, you know, how it's going to come out and what is going to be included in it. So I think people are going to be really freaking happy. If there's people out there that are happy with this one, they're going to be ecstatic with this next one. It'd be great to get a label or great to get some help.
If you do end up needing to go like a Kickstarter type thing, you know, just give me the info and I'll post it on the page for you.
Thank you. Sledge Leather Project on Facebook. They won't let us change it to Sledge Leather. They insist that we leave the name as it was. I'm like, great, thanks. Or go to sledgeleather.com and you can get info on what we're doing. Or the Twitter account actually is probably the best place to go, @SledgeLeather. And it gets probably updated the most of anything. Although, the Facebook definitely gets updated.
Yeah.
And I hope people in Europe are able to access all that, because it seems like there's a lot of people out there who are fans that haven't found us. We'll try to put some YouTube stuff up. Again, it's money that I don't want to spend, you know, making a video for the last record when it could be going into production for the next record. But we do have some footage for Imagine Me Alive that looks really cool. And hopefully we can get it up there.
And you're selling the record through iTunes, and I think Amazon has it as well, right? It says MP3?
Amazon, MP3, iTunes, or, you know, go to sledgeleather.com and you can order it direct from us using PayPal.
Okay, well, with that, Sandy, I'd like to thank you for joining me here on Third Eye Cinema, and I'd certainly love to have you back on and discuss the next album, particularly if it's anywhere near as good as this one is.
Thank you, Gene. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
metal
like
up, everyone. All right. Thanks,
so
Gene. It was great. Weather was right. You're amazing. So knowledgeable. She gave me a heads up on you. She really enjoyed talking with you. It's great talking to you.
You too. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
And to close out our interview with Sandy, here's Sandy and Leather today off of Sledge Leather. This is The Lost Forgiveness.
That's okay, all the monsters. They're frail to lie exposed under. They're stones that crumble. And now I'm silent.
faces, their mistakes now
Dalton of Free Ideas and Sandy Sledge of Sledge Mother. Next week, on week 65 of Third Eye Cinema, Nige Rocket of UK Thrash Pioneers Onslaught. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker, a musician, and like to join us on here, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network. I'm Bob Talk. This or any of the Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. And next week.
Hi, this is Nige Rocket from Onslaught, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Once upon a morning, there was a freshly brewed McCafe coffee. It was made with 100% Arabica beans, yet something was missing. Fear not, in the distance, a sausage McMuffin with egg rides toward the sunrise in quest for breakfast. The perfect pair met at McDonald's, and mornings were happy forever after. Right now, get a $1 small coffee and a $2 sausage McMuffin with egg from the $1, $2, $3 menu. Prices and participation may vary, cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.